The following message is copyrighted by Westminster Theological Seminary. Duplication, distribution, or other use of all or any part of this message is not permitted without prior written consent. Please direct your inquiries to communications@wts.edu. For all other information, please visit the main website at www.wts.edu.
As you can see from the way I'm describing the history of Bach criticism or Bach or thinking about Bach research, the movement is from sort of secular to very romantic ideas of the sacred, going right up to the idea of the fifth evangelist, and then to a more scientific, supposedly scientific ideal. In 1926, which is before the 300th anniversary, but which was a great inspiration to some of the newer direction in scholarship, a man named Frederick Smend, S-M-E-N-D, a German, says that to really understand Bach, you have to look deeply into the structure of his compositions. And he came up with the idea that the key for Bach's composition was a complex number system and chiastic structure. And I'm looking at one thing here, one example of this, where in the St. John's Passion, you take the various choruses. 29. I'll write this up without writing the titles, because the titles explain it all. But it's a little complicated to write all that. But if you take the choruses understand their message, which I'll tell you in just a second, you find the following symmetrical pattern. 40 is the middle one, and 40 is a chorale. Durch dein Gefängnis Gottes Sohn. At the heart of this chorale is the idea that there's a substitution of Christ for humankind at the cross. It's a very beautiful chorale. It roughly translated, it is by your slavery, Son of God, liberty is obtained for us. Your prison is the throne of grace, the refuge of all the believers. For if you had not become a slave, our slavery would be forever. Okay, so there's a wonderful substitutionary atonement in terms of slavery. And he says, If you look at this carefully, you'll find exact symmetry between 38 and 42, which surround it. Musical symmetry between 36 and 44, and then this kind of structure here between those. And each of these are the ones, I don't know if you're familiar with the St. John's Passion, but 29 is nicht diesen nicht, sondern Barnabam, not this one, but Barnabas. Is that his name? Barabbas, sorry. Then it says we only have one king, that's Caesar. And then 36 and 44 say Kreuzige, crucify him. And 46 and 50 go back to the first. So it seems like we only have one king. That's the only one we want. Substitute Barabbas and so forth, down to crucify him, down to his slavery became our freedom from slavehood. You've got this kind of central mobile like structure that centers on the chorale, and this man Smend did a lot of work to try to show that this was the heart of Bach's compositional technique. Now, the problem for me is that, yes, I think there is some symmetry, and Bach was aware of that, but I think that he was much more of a theologian than a mathematician. That the idea of the cross is not this abstract X which can be symbolized by all these different symmetries, but was a true idea of a substitutionary atonement, the Christian sensibility. This his worldview was so profoundly Christian that it's not as if he was just preaching a message through the vehicle of music, but he did use almost everything in music to get across the Christian worldview. There's a we don't have much on Bach's aesthetics. There's a fascinating book by Mendel which collects all these writings about Bach. And one of the things he's come up with is notes taken by a student in his theory class. And the note simply says, here Bach tells us when we're writing the thorough bass, which is the continuo part, the bass which goes along, you know, in the Baroque style, to make it clear and articulate. Otherwise, you will have a devilish hubbub which can never be to the glory of God. So the clarity and the articulation of the thorough bass for Bach was a statement about God's clarity. And his compositions are permeated with this sense of let's be clear, let's articulate, because that's what God loves, is clarity. But it's not that he... that his music was this kind of simple vehicle for some message. All of these principles are there, but they're not. They don't kind of explain his reasons for choosing things. In reaction to this whole idea of the religious direction and the symmetrical direction, I mean, the extreme of which is a guy like Mellors in England who talked about the dance of God and so on. In reaction to this, a radical approach was tried in the 1960s. This approach, spearheaded by a Frenchman named Condé, C-A-N-D-E, and the German Blume, who wrote a massive volume on Protestant church music, which has a lot of valuable things, but this reaction simply said that Bach was a church musician, a professional with no particular spirituality. He was doing his job. And pointed out that in his middle period, where he was working at the secular reformed court at Köthen, Bach was never happier and his music was never better, because that's what he was doing. He was just a professional musician writing when the occasion permitted. This reaction, I believe, was a much too extreme reaction, but it did counterbalance the extreme religious view. Bach, indeed, often borrowed from his secular works to build sacred themes. He was not... committed to some huge dichotomy between the sacred and the secular. Some of his parts of the Christmas Oratorio, for example, are taken out of his secular cantatas, which have themes like election day or birthdays or celebrations or whatever they might be. He did use all of the skills of a church musician, and I think that it's only fair to say that he had a real professional calling. Nevertheless, having said all that, I think a more balanced view tries to show that he was a church musician for more than just professional reasons. Let me give you a couple of justifications for that. The social context. This was the context of Lutheranism. In the Lutheran Church, you had several parties. You had the Orthodox Party, And then you had the pietists. Pietism was born in Germany, in the Lutheran Church, around the late 1600s. In 1675, at Frankfurt, Philip Jakob Spener published a book called Pia Desideria, Pious Desires, in which he appeals to a more personal, private, practical faith than the great official church allowed for. After his death, August Hermann Francke took his place and, in the name of a more personal and lively religion, founded all kinds of good missions and works. Modern missions owes a lot to the Pietist movement. Pietism was not so much a questioning of the church, but, as the name implies, of the church's worship and piety. Pietists wanted to get the message of Christ across by conveying what he had done to the individual, to a person's heart, whereas the more orthodox party wanted to do it through the general preaching of the word and through liturgy. Now, as you can imagine, the controversy in music that developed was between the orthodox and the pietist, a matter of complex music versus more simple music. That was one part of the controversy. This next piece... Oh, no. Oh, that's the... Okay, I should have played that for you. That's chorale number 40 on the slavery. Dein Kerker ist der Gnadenthron. Your prison is the great throne of grace. The refuge of all the faithful. Denn gingst du nicht die Knechtschaft ein. If you had not become slave, musst unsere Knechtschaft ewig sein. Our own slavery would be eternal. Now, very complex music from more of the orthodox sense. This is the Art of the Fugue, number 18. It's a four-voice fugue, which is mathematically one of the most complex things ever written. And it's, you know, it sounds great, but if you know what's involved, it's just the work of mathematical genius. That dum bum bum bum. That's the inverse version of bum 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 bum, which is the main theme of the fugue. So he has inversions and retrogrades and things upside down and backwards. No, I didn't do a very good job. Sorry about that. This very complex style was objected to by the Pietists, who said this is just going to confuse believers. It's you know, mathematically very, very nice, but it didn't speak from the heart. Bach, I believe, was committed to both orthodoxy and Pietism in some ways. For his appreciation of the place of music and the importance of music, he was orthodox. In Mühlhausen, he got into a fight with the Pietists, who didn't want complicated music, but loved just little refrains and very simple stuff repeated over and over again. And Bach said, no, God is worthy of far greater glory than just these constant refrains. At the same time, his cantatas and his passions are based on poetry, poetic texts, which were created by Pietist poets. And the emotion and passion of Bach's music is often very much indebted to the personal, heartfelt style of the Pietists, and to the concertato style, the Baroque, the dramatic, which is such a characteristic of Bach's music. Here's an example of that from the St. John's Passion, the aria, the tenor aria, Ach mein Sinn, O my soul, is Peter, after having denied Christ three times. And I've just backed it up here, that little clip there, and it'll continue, where the woman at the little fireplace there says, are you not one of his disciples? And Peter swears and denies it and so forth. And then it says in the text, he went outside, ging hinaus und weinete bitterlich. He went outside and cried bitterly. And you'll see in the crying, there's a chromatic descent, just like whining, very kind of pictorial. And then this wonderful aria, Ach mein Sinn, O my soul, wo willst du endlich hin? Where will you go in the end? Wo soll ich mich erquicken? How can I console myself? And this is Pietism in music. Bist du nicht? Are you not? Seine Jünger, one of his Jünger's disciples. Great sense of the crowd saying, come on, you know you are. Aren't you one? Not me. Here's the aria, at least part of it. I don't know if I recorded the whole thing. know who's singing? Fischer Dieskau.
That's a,
yeah, long time ago. Then he belonged to both schools in the sense that officially he supported the Orthodox, but in his music he was very much a dramatic pietist writer. But it's not simplistic pietism. The pietists, for example, objected to any dance forms, whereas Bach wrote dance music, French suites, English suites, the peasant cantata, and he was very much against taking the fun out of life in the name of religion. What is certain is that he distanced himself from the rationalism of the 18th century. And though Orthodox, he had a lively enough faith so that he objected to simply making music a kind of sensory perception of physical properties. You know that in the 18th century is when Rameau wrote his book, The Treatise on Harmony, Reduced to Its Natural Causes, and he basically said, music is like taking a stretched string, and when you take the stretched string and you go half, it's an octave. When you go two-thirds, it's a fifth. And music just puts all these mathematical principles together, and that's what it is. Bach says, no, music is much, much deeper than that. He says, if you want to call music a science, that's fine, but it's a useful science. Music was not for the purpose simply of enjoyment and of diversion, but it was, of course, to the glory of God. Bach's faith comes out, you can witness to it in some of his writings, in some of the controversies he engaged in, but perhaps most of all in the texts of his work. He wrote in his cantatas that he was longing for the day when he would meet God and be released from all the miseries of this world, and music was a way to remind him of that release that would be coming forth. So Bach was both a pietist and an Orthodox. Even though he took the side of the Orthodox in many of the controversies, he was committed to true religion and true piety, as his music shows and as his controversial writings also show. Secondly, Bach and the Bible. Bach's library has been pretty much rediscovered, not all the books in it, but the catalogs that were in it. In 1934, they made a remarkable discovery, which is Bach's Bible. And the editor of Bach's Bible was a man named Kalov. And the fascinating thing about this is a Bible that many people used in his day in the Lutheran Church. And the fascinating thing about the Bible is that in the text, in the margins, he has all kinds of notes which guide us to know what was important to him and what wasn't. I have here a facsimile of Bach's Bible, which I'll let you look at. You can see the type of thing that it is. As you go through the texts, you go through the various passages of the Scripture, you'll find that he'll say very often, N.B. next to the text, nota bene, and it will be next to something that has a great deal of importance for theology or for music. Next to the text of 1 Corinthians 26, he writes in the margin, dieses Kapitel ist das wahre Fundament aller gottgefällige Kirchenmusik. This chapter is the true foundation of all church music that is agreeable to God. And, of course, as you know, 1 Corinthians 26 is about the choirs of the temple and so on. And Bach really believed that that's where you got your marching orders. In 1 Chronicles 29:21, and also 2 Chronicles 5:13, which are also texts about music, he has a note that says, N.B., with sacred music, God is always present by His grace. And so he believed that sacred music was a place of the presence of God. Often he underlines texts. Interestingly enough, well, let me make you guess. Which book of the Bible do you think is the most underlined by Bach? You would think so, wouldn't you? But it is not so. You'll never guess. Well, it's the book of Ecclesiastes. Yeah. Because it seems that this book, for Kalloff, who was the editor, and for Bach following that editor, evoked, perhaps more than others, the Lutheran theology of suffering, patient acceptance of conditions, and the resolution of that in the cross. Because they believed that Ecclesiastes, of course, was enigmas that were common to man, but that were resolved in by sacrificing all of your cares to God at the cross. And so it's an extraordinary testimony to Bach's awareness of the deep truths of theology. And as you go through that Bible, and as well as other books in his library, which were commentaries, theological treatises and stuff, you realize how much he knew about Christianity. And that I think is a rare thing. You know, even today, how many church musicians are real experts in Christianity? Bach was, because he believed it. Third, so we have the controversy and the things that he decided on between the Pietists and the Lutherans. Second, his Bible. And let me, before we get to the third point, let me illustrate that with an excerpt from Cantata 56. Ich will den Kreuzstab gerne tragen. Let me just quickly translate the text here. I hold myself firm and ready to receive my joyful inheritance, so much desired and so much searched for from the hand of Jesus. What happiness when this will occur. When I will arrive at the door of peace, there, the porte de ruga, yeah, door of peace. There, maybe not the the port, the you know, where a boat arrives. There, I will leave all of my miseries forever in the grave, and my Savior will wipe away my own tears. Die Tränen mein. Come, O death, brother of sleep, Schlafes Bruder, come and bring me, leave free the rudder of my boat and take me to the port. Maybe someone is worried, but as for me, you only give me joy, and it's by you that I will enter to see my soft Jesus. This is a typical text of Bach, set in the sense that it's from the parts of the Bible where suffering is relieved by the certainty of going to the final seaport.
come, O death.
Let me just read you one comment that is quite precious here. He's, as I say, in the book of Ecclesiastes, he has the most. He's commenting here on part of Ecclesiastes, and he says, it's the part which says, I grow indeed tired and weary, for it is irritating when wise people expend great effort and labor to accomplish governance and good works, and when their results are the very best, they are scorned and shown ingratitude. Bach says, therefore, Solomon wants to lead us to letting God's will be done in life and in death, in things both great and small, to use those things that God provides, and not be anxious about the future, rather trusting these things to God who works through us, often without our knowing it, just as the horses and oxen plow and do their work without being able to concern themselves further. Thus shall we carry out what God places in our hands and bear whatever he imparts to us without need in our lives for other purposes than to work, each according to his profession, and to gain from this our lot and ration of bread. And then one more thing here. This is the thing on the time for... There's a time for building up and a time for tearing down. And we conclude from them that all human efforts, all thinking, doing, planning, is only sham, shallow, and deception unless the matter is already decided in heaven. Kings, princes, and masters may hold counsel, resolve everything. If a matter's hour comes round, it passes on. The other remains unresolved and strike themselves. Even if all men on earth could tear themselves apart, God will not let them set the clock, the kings, the princes, the masters on earth. He will set the clock himself. We should not tell him what occurs. He will tell us. And it's just on with just all these insights, you know, from he could have almost written a commentary. Third and finally, the music itself is the key to Bach's true commitments to Christianity, neither as a romantic sacred nor as a pure professional musician, but as a Christian who wanted to serve God. Here a couple of directions can be indicated. First of all, the intentions of the composer we can gather from the fact of, first of all, frequently he wrote Soli Deo Gloria or J.J., Jesu Juva, Jesus Help Me, on almost every one of his texts, just all over the place. Second of all, this is an interesting detail, in 1708, kind of a young man still, he resigned from Mühlhausen, where he had had these problems with the Pietists, but also he had another thing. He told the council, which had hired him, the following thing. Thus, God decided to give me a situation, or provide for me a situation which would permit not only better to assure my physical needs, but also make possible, without contradicting others, to persevere, to work towards my life's objective. That is, to well order the music of the church. That's his life's objective. Well order the music of the church. His idea is that the church is the key to the voice of God, and in order that people hear that voice clearly, the music of it has to be also well ordered. And I think that the center of his ministry was really to lead people to the throne of grace. Now, to be sure, he had a lot of frustrations in his life. To be sure, he was probably happier in Köthen at the secular court. It was a reformed court, so they didn't have church music. than in almost any other place in his career. Leipzig, where he ended up his career with the choir there, there were a lot of difficulties, a lot of frustrations. Nevertheless, he felt that it was important to go to a place where he could well order the music of the church, rather than just pause where he was having a more fulfilling kind of musical life, because he believed that God had called him to it. One can get a good idea of his theology from the music. One of the things that I've looked at a lot is, what's his theology of the atonement? I believe basically it is substitutionary. But I also think that he paid a great deal of attention to the theme of the victory, the Christus Victor. Let me just give you this example from, again, the St. John's Passion. There's a brief solo which says, "Mein teuer Heiland, my dear Savior, you ask why you needed to go to the cross, but you yourself said the answer, all is accomplished." Now, I think that's a fair summary of Bach's theology of the atonement. It was finished, it was done, and it was accomplished. And then the choir answers, "Jesus, then, although you were dead, you now live eternally. In the last night of death, I could go nowhere. Now that you have died, I can go to heaven." So I think this is the heart of his theology, which is best of all tested in his music. Sorry about this. I'm starting to collect the cantatas on CD now, so you don't get all this noise. Sense the victory of this, just in the sound of it. Sorry. I think Routley says it pretty well on 53 and in other places. Bach was in himself an extraordinary combination. He was in one way a child of his age, fitting peaceably into the prevailing fashions of court and church music. None of his music suggests that he's a rebellious social misfit, whatever his day-to-day sentiments might have been. At Arnstadt, Mühlhausen, Leipzig, he was an organist, so he wrote for the organ. At Köthen, he was a court musician, so he wrote for secular music. At Weimar, he was a choir master, so he wrote for the choir. And at Leipzig, he wrote for the august ceremonies of the Thomaskirche. He wrote 18th century music, not affecting any antiquarianism. A modal chorale becomes an 18th century chorus in his hands. He was content to do what this world required of him, and in this became perhaps the last of the medieval craftsmen. He was the most detached of all musicians from any preoccupation with what effect his music would have on any but those for whom it was composed. The most unromantic and matter-of-fact of workmen, he was no great tragic figure, no frustrated, Byronic, melodramatic bohemian asking to be discovered by some Hollywood producer and made into a legend. He was an ordinary middle-class tradesman in music and an ordinary middle-class churchman. Middle-class because he was of the 18th century, but a tradesman and churchman because he was spiritually independent of ambition and lust for influence. It must be admitted that some who had to work with him or employed him found him a difficult colleague or employee, but this was always because he protested whenever he thought it right against conditions of work that made it unnecessarily difficult for him to be a good workman. He was as good a musician, he was as good a musical trade unionist as was Samuel Wesley in English history, but if his behavior was occasionally the behavior of protest, his music was preeminently the music of acceptance. That lacks a bit of passion and spirituality, but I think it's a good point and a very good rectification of some of the excesses of the Romantic Bach. He wrote music of acceptance, but it was all for this higher goal of the well-ordering of church music to the glory of God and for the edification of the people. And I think in that way he remains a model for us as Christian people who are involved with music. And I'm hoping that music research will move in that direction and will show more and more that Bach was a well-rounded but unromantic workman, craftsman, for God's purposes. And, you know, the final lesson for me is that in doing something small and modest and doing it well, you're much more universal than if you try to be universal. And so that's what I think, that would be the goal for church music for today, as well as for the 18th century. And of course, that the styles and the contexts are very different today, but I think the principles are the same. So, there you have it. Any questions, remarks? You wrote a lot of stuff down there. Oh, okay. That's an honest. Okay. Yeah, no, that's fine. That's a good thing to do. Any questions about this or any previous stuff? Mm-hmm. Well, it'll be drawn some from the reading. You know, ask you to comment on Spencer's, you know, approach to popular music or something, or on Routley's view of Bach or whatever, and some from the lectures and the stuff that we've gone over in class. It'll be mostly essays, probably small essays, you know, not massive things on your views of, you know, church music, but two or three paragraph answers on a fairly specific question, a series of them. And I always give choices. So, yeah, we covered a lot of different things, didn't we? Yeah. There'll probably be a question or two on aesthetics, you know, the romantic versus the critical or whatever. There'll be some stuff on the whole notion of popular music, drawing partly from Dave Petty and then partly from the stuff in the Spencer book and my work on spirituals and questions of authenticity and stuff. No, it won't be anything scary. Just be the best way to prepare for it is go over your notes, go over the reading again. That's what I'd say. Yeah, a series of shorter essay questions. Is that what I said? Yeah. Well,
yeah, that was a long time ago.
Yeah, it was a long time ago. Did I say I'd give you 2 out of 3? Three essay. Yeah, well, that's about right. Maybe it's going to be 4 instead of 3. You know, an hour a piece, something like that. So, yeah. Okay. Well, I guess that's about it. We can. I should have brought you some sample questions or something, but you know, there'll be things. It'll just be stuff like. Is Routley correct that Bach was a musician of acceptance rather than a romantic? So then you have to draw on what you know about romanticism and the rebel, the hero, the insufficiency of the Old Testament according to Routley's view. Then you can criticize that. So it'd be stuff like that. That's about as specific as it'll probably get.